You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
It began modestly in 1979 when a group of friends decided to compare notes on some of the top restaurants in New York City. Today, Nina and Tim Zagat have expanded that survey concept to include guides for nearly three dozen cities around the world, covering everything from restaurants to nightlife, hotels to shopping. And these days, the New York City Zagat Restaurant Guide, a.k.a. the Burgundy Bible, includes reviews of over 2,000 eateries in all five boroughs. Joining me now are Nina and Tim Zagat, the founders of the Zagat Survey. It's always a pleasure to see you. You have something, what did you say, how many cities now, 35?
No, we're in 88 cities.
88, I can't keep up with you, Tim.
And for the hotels, resorts, and spas, we're doing over 100 countries.
And it all started off with one sheet.
It all started off with one mimeograph sheet. That's how long ago it was.
It was like kind of a small circle of friends who just wanted to compare notes?
Yeah, basically we started with 20 people, and we asked each of our friends to give us 10 other friends. And the first year we had 200 people rating roughly 100 restaurants. And now we have close to 400,000 people rating restaurants around the world, about 40,000 restaurants and hotels.
What's shocking to me, looking at that original list, the class of 79, as you call it, is how many of these restaurants still are operating in New York. A few have gone, but I would say at least two-thirds are still here, which says either you had a really interesting list or maybe the Zagat guides have helped keep a few of these alive.
Well, we tried to pick originally the best restaurants, and the best restaurants tend to have the greatest longevity. But there are only now about 34 out of the original 100 that are still alive. And the thing that's amazing...
Well, some of them died and came back, like Phoenix Gardens mm-hmm. and Le Cirque and a few others here. So some restaurants, I guess the names are so important, they have second lives.
Well, you know, Le Cirque really has been consistently, it just moved a number of times. It's always been run by the Maccioni family, Sirio particularly. But, you know, I was looking at the reviews, the original reviews of some of these places, the Algonquin and Barbetta and Café des Artistes. Chanterelle, I think yesterday, had its 30th anniversary. Mm-hmm. Many of the reviews back then were right on in terms of you could have read the review today, and you said, that's the same restaurant.
In fact, Peter Lugers, in the original survey, said, uniformly praised, super steaks and no more.
And you could say the same thing today.
Yeah. Funny, we made this list on pages 8 and 9 of the guide, where it shows things that were said or something that was going on in 1979, and then what the same thing would be called today. For example, if I may, bartender, mixologist, bread, amuse-bouche, smoking between courses, texting between courses.
That's my favorite. I think it's so right on.
Well, texting is necessary because a lot of restaurants aren't allowing you to use your cell phone, which I, by the way, appreciate.
I do, too.
Although it's annoying when the person next to you starts texting as well.
Yeah. Well, Nina is texting kind of all the time, and it's a constant.
You're not doing it now, Nina. Thank you.
That's right. It's all off.
It's an issue in our home. But, you know, I'm looking at one of the things here is Second Avenue Deli on Second Avenue. Second Avenue Deli on 3rd Avenue, off 3rd Avenue. Tablecloth, table.
$20 meal, $20 appetizer.
Yes, isn't that extraordinary?
Prefix, omakase. Estate wine, estate chocolate. Everything seems to, you know, gambling in Vegas. Dining in Vegas.
Isn't that extraordinary what happened in Las Vegas?
Yeah.
So the changes over the last 30 years are really very interesting.
When did the guide start looking the way we now know it?
In 1982. November, we came out with the 83 guide, which looked very much like the current one. It had the burgundy cover.
Although it keeps on getting thicker and thicker as you add things, and at a certain point, maybe you're going to have to decide whether you want to change it just so that it can fit in a pocket.
Well, what we do is try to not let the guide get any thicker and add additional restaurants on Sagat.com. And then people can really have access to the additional places, but we can't make the guide thicker than something that people can fit in their pockets.
We've basically held it at 2,000 restaurants, and that's because, at least in book form, we want to have it easy to carry.
Is that why there are no restaurants that are rated below 17? That you just
are we no restaurants rated?
That not that I could find.
That's not true. Just leafing through, I see one here that has service of 13 and decor of 12. Yeah, maybe you're referring to the food rating.
The food,
right?
We tried, by the way, to put in places that we're effectively recommending. So you're not going to see if a restaurant does very badly in food. Unless it is a Mama Leone's or a place that fundamentally you have to warn people about, we are going to not list it. Or if it has low votes, we may not list it. Because what we really want to do is be able to say these are reliably good places to go to. In the website, on the other hand, where we have unlimited scope and no restrictions on what we can do, I just found a 12 and a 13. A 12 for food.
And I found
Elaine's.
A decor of 6.
I mean, there are...
Elaine's, you know, one of the most popular places in New York.
Here's one page that has got Egg with an 11 for decor, 8 Mile Creek, a 13 for decor, EJ's Luncheonette, a 9 for decor, and a 16 for food. And guess what? At the bottom, this is just one page. You didn't read it carefully.
I didn't read that page.
Elaine's, 12, 13, 13. Let me give you the review. I want you to know we still can stick it to them.
This is Elaine's. Now, we should point out Elaine's is a popular place with the literati.
Right.
Many people, writers, go there regularly to drink and eat. And you give it a 13?
You know, it got once a quote, which was... a literary hangout, which originated the term writer's cramp. long renowned as the literary crowd haunt and book party central, Elaine Kaufman's Upper East Side Italian-American endures despite pricey pedestrian fare, indifferent service, and tired decor. Clubby older writers argue it isn't about the food. But ultimately, if they don't know you, they don't want to know you. As one surveyor says, it would be for has-beens.
Whoa.
But, you know, there are lots of places.
I'm glad I don't hang out there.
I want to
talk about that for just a moment longer, because what we heard there was a bunch of quotes, right? When people send in things, comments, and you pick out the best ones, you find yourself laughing out loud?
Absolutely, but we don't just pick out the ones we like most. We try to pick out the ones that are most representative of what people are saying again and again and again. Any quote usually represents a fairly large number of other people saying more or less the same thing.
But the two of you eat out a lot, and have you ever... seen a restaurant get pretty bad reviews, even though you think it's very good?
No. Really, no. We have seen a lot of times, one of the advantages of a survey is it reflects a large number of people's opinion. And sometimes one group of people loves it, another group hates it. Well, we've never been in a restaurant where we were not in either one. We didn't have company. You virtually can't be, when you have the number of surveyors we have, 38,000 in New York, and the average restaurant is visited 1,000 times or more a year, probably every time we're in a restaurant, there are three people there who are rating it. You know, if you have normal taste buds and normal taste, you're going to find some people, at least a minority, agree with you, and most of the time we find the majority agrees with us. I've never been in a restaurant where I ever felt that, my God, this is wrong.
To the contrary, I always find it exciting when we go to other cities and we pick a place out from the guide and we go and we just, you know, feel, wow, it's right on.
Because the New York, you may have gone to most of the restaurants that are in the guide, many of the restaurants that are in the guide. But when you go to one of the other cities, 88, you say now?
88 cities around the world, and maybe more because we're doing several in China.
You, when you're going there, of course, you're just relying on the locals.
Absolutely.
To fill up, to assess their local restaurants. My guests are Nina and Tim Zagat, the founders of the Zagat Survey. Nina, who was one of our most distinguished lawyers before, she wound up doing this. Did you give up that career totally?
Yes.
You won one of the most celebrated cases, that the Johnson and Johnson case?
Sure.
And you won for the wife who was being sued by the family.
Well, I represented the estate.
It's amazing that you even bothered going into any business after that. I suspect that was for lawyers, that must have been a very, very nice payoff.
Well, it was a very interesting case.
So 79, you started the guide as a mimeograph sheet. 82, you're already publishing it. I'm assuming you thought it was still only going to be for a small group of people, maybe New Yorkers only. When did you realize that this was bigger than you could have ever envisioned?
Well, it was 3 years where we just gave it away as a hobby. And then when we started selling it, it was because Nina felt our hobby was too expensive and wanted to make it tax deductible. We broke even the first year, which amazed us, and mostly selling to our own surveyors. And a couple of years later, New York Magazine, in the December of 1985, did a cover story and had lots and lots of content from us. And our sales went from 40,000 copies a year to 75,000 copies a month in 1 month, right on, really, because of that. And suddenly we were making, and by the way, we couldn't get anybody to publish, so we had nobody to share our revenue with. So we were making $500,000 in 1 month. And even though we were both well paid as lawyers, we never dreamed of our hobby becoming so successful. When that happened, we started saying, maybe we've invented a better mousetrap, and let's take it on the road again, because Nina, being a tax lawyer, she wanted to have more expenses to take down our income. And so we went to L.A., San Francisco, Chicago, and Washington.
So you kept on trying to take down the income and instead increased it.
Yes. And next year we had the five best-selling guides.
We felt we had a willing partner to help us expand our business.
Now, how did
it's like the United States government keeping the banks alive.
That's right.
How did the restaurant owners react to the survey when it was first established?
Well, I think at the very beginning, they wanted to learn more about it and weren't quite sure. But I think what we found is that they realized that lots of their customers have a much more upbeat attitude towards restaurants than a critic who's going in with the function of finding things that might not be right.
A critic is definitionally critical. It doesn't mean the critic doesn't love restaurants, but every day has to go to another one, has to write about it, and is supposed to point out what the foibles of the restaurant are. So they inherently sound more critical than they may be. Our surveyors, on the other hand, are people who love restaurants, who are avid, and generally, if there's a fault, are maybe a little bit too enthusiastic.
There's another side. When a critic reviews a restaurant in the New York Times, let's say, the odds are I haven't been to that restaurant, and so I really have no context to compare the review with. But when I go through the guide, and my friends tell me the same thing, they often compare their experiences with the ones that they're reading about in the guide.
Right.
Sometimes agreeing, sometimes disagreeing.
Well, I hope that they all come to Zagat.com to express their own views.
Now, that was another change, wasn't it? For many years, you sent out a printed form with very narrow lines in which people had to write all of their opinions. Now it's all done on the Internet?
Now it's all done on Zagat.com. People come and we hope, will rate restaurants all year long, give their ratings and their pithy, witty comments, and anybody who's willing to have their comments displayed on Zagat.com, they're right up there.
Can they vote on Zagat.mobi yet?
Yes, you can also vote on Zagat.mobi, which is our mobile application, which you can get on any internet-enabled mobile device. And you can get all the content that's on Zagat.com.
Doesn't she sound techie? I mean, she really is.
And even more, because we have shopping on Zagat.mobi as well.
You can vote on the iPhone. You can vote on your BlackBerry. Nina has got all of these things sort of plugged into her navel at all times.
No wonder you're doing all the texting. We have to take a little break. When we come back, I want to find out just what the economic crisis's impact is and some of the other, and talk about some of the new restaurants, some of the places that you found exciting and your respondents have found exciting, and also whether you see any trends. But first, this. My guests, by the way, are Tim and Nina Zagat, and the brand new 30th edition of the Zagat Guide, New York City Restaurants 2009, is just out. We're back with Tim and Nina Zagat talking about the 30th edition of the Zagat Guide, the 2009 New York City Restaurants edition. And it's just out and has all sorts of interesting things. According to your most recent results, 38% of New Yorkers say that they're eating out less frequently because of the economic crisis. And that was before the real economic crisis. So what kind of impact do you think that's going to have on local restaurants?
Well, actually, we've been getting results right up to the minute, practically. You know, it's not only eating out less, they're eating in less expensive places, they're skipping alcohol or appetizers or desserts. They're doing everything they can to make dining out more affordable for themselves, and it's going to hurt. It's no question it's going to cut into profitability.
Well, there have been other economic downturns while you've been publishing these guides. There was that stock market crash in 1987. How long before things recovered?
They take a while, but the fact is, the one thing that people don't understand is that there are some very fundamental demographics that have been pushing the restaurant industry through over 30 years in what is really a revolution. And as a result of that, even during the 9/11, 1987, the Carter energy crisis, the number of new restaurants exceeded the number of closings, and the restaurant industry continued to expand, although much less profitably. People have to target things that are less. I mean, the city of New York has thousands of restaurants. The ones that mostly you read about and hear about are the big name, fancy, top of the line places. But the great majority of seats are in little places which we call bath restaurants, better alternative to home. And they're the ones that line the avenues all over the city, and they have homey, hearty food of all kinds. They're casual, and they're inexpensive.
And they, in some cases, one or two will then lead to a boom, and you wind up with a destination area, whether it's Smith Street and or Fifth Avenue in Brooklyn, or whether it's Flushing, areas in Flushing, or the Arthur Avenue section in the Bronx. And the next thing you know, you have a whole bunch of restaurants competing with each other and raising the standards. But then eventually they start charging high prices.
We've always specialized in locating a lot of places where people can eat economically, because our view always has been that of course, you go to special occasion restaurants, but you also want to eat as part of your daily life, and you can't go to fancy, expensive restaurants all the time and don't really want to in most cases. And this year's guide has 648 restaurants where you can eat for under $30.
For dinner and under $20 for lunch.
and 419 restaurants where you can eat for under $25.
So they don't have those $20 appetizers.
That's for sure. Plus, we have several pages in the guide, all different kinds of Best Buys, and places that have prefix menus so that you can go to really quite elegant places at the right time and have a certain prefix menu and eat very lovely.
Is that the way the high-end restaurants are coping with this problem by instituting prefix menus?
Prefix menus started in 1992 with Restaurant Week. Joe Baum and I had originated that. And we didn't know what we were doing because we thought it was just a way to promote the city for a few days.
And it was $19.92 in those days. You know, as time goes on, the price keeps on going up.
But it's in terms
at
of
the right rate.
But in terms of present dollars, it's a better deal today. The restaurant weeks that are being held are really a better deal today than they were in 1992, 17 years ago. But look at this. You have restaurants like Anthos, $28 for a three-course. Asiat, which is the best-looking, highest decor-rated restaurant, a wonderful place, $24 for three courses.
But it's always the same thing, chicken or salmon.
No, not at all. And you have something, I go to Jean Georges because it's opposite my office, and also because it's one of the best restaurants in America or maybe even the world. And Jean Georges has a $24 three-course prefix.
That changes all the time and is always whatever is in season and that the chef thinks is terrific.
So what happens
folks
with
have figured that out, by the way. I mean, Jean Georges is packed every day at lunch.
What happens with the really expensive restaurants like Masa, which has an average price, according to this year's guide, of $520 a person? Can they attract enough diners to stay in business?
Well, they only have about 30 seats, and I would suggest that Masa's cost of just the ingredients are probably $300 a person. It's not as if anybody is going to go there, but when you think of people buying floor seats at the Garden to see the Knicks play, and not very well either.
We're hoping for a better year this year.
We promise you the better year, but it has to be better than last year. But the fact is people pay a lot for the things they love, and foodies, there are enough foodies to fill Massa every day of the year, and it does do what it does amazingly well. It's just I'm not about to spend $500 for lunch or dinner.
In the past, the people who kept most of those restaurants going were people at Wall Street and also people who were coming from other countries. Are they going to be the main supporters of these restaurants? Because the dollar is also cheap, although Europe is going through its own economic crisis.
Well, the dollar is rising now, and I used to be head of tourism in New York, and we benefited enormously from the low dollar. It's going to be tougher because as the dollar rises, it becomes more expensive for Europeans to come here. The fact is that the very, very best restaurants, the ones that you used to have to wait for an hour, rather for a month to get into, and when you finally reached them, they sounded like they were irritated that you were bothering to call them, are going to be more welcoming, and they are going to take your reservations on shorter notice. So from the standpoint of a consumer who wants that kind of experience, it's going to be a pleasanter. On the other hand, the vast majority of restaurants are, in fact, relatively inexpensive. The inflation rate overall in the last 30 years for the restaurants of New York has been about 2%, a little above it, whereas the consumer price index has been 6.6%. That means that from the standpoint of you and me, the restaurants overall in the city are a far better bargain than they used to be.
How does New York compare to some of the other places you have guides for?
It's more expensive than pretty much every city except Las Vegas.
In the United States.
Yeah.
But
it's
I would
nowhere
imagine
near
Paris and London are more expensive.
Paris, London, Tokyo, Osaka. We do guides in 28 cities in Europe. Everywhere outside of the United States. We may look expensive here, but we're half the price of a meal in London, for example.
Do any of the survey respondents live outside the United States?
Oh, sure.
But not very
you
many.
You mean the ones that vote in London, for example?
For New York.
Oh.
Not really. They're almost all people who live here because we know the patterns. I mean, they have to be voting on a lot of places. And therefore, if you were living in London, you couldn't do that.
Are you seeing changes? For example, has slow food made an impact? Are we seeing restaurants that are thinking more green than they did in the past?
It's funny. We had dinner with Alice Waters, who is probably the queen of slow food, just over the weekend. I think that a lot of the values of slow food have been coming along in an amazing way. It hasn't been slow at all. They've been coming into play pretty fast. Green issues. 5 years ago, I didn't know anybody who knew what sustainably raised food was. This year, we asked our surveyors in New York if they would like sustainably raised food. 60-something percent said they would pay more for sustainably raised food, that they wanted local food, 60%, organic food, 60%. These numbers are growing year in, year out, and they are growing all over the country. It is not surprising that the West Coast has been ahead of the East Coast, but you get places like Seattle, Washington, it's now 80% of the people saying that sustainably raised food is what they want.
We even have a restaurant in Westchester where Blue Hill, where it's in the middle of a farm, and they just go out and they pick the vegetables and cook them immediately.
They have spectacular vegetables there. We were just there a couple of weeks ago, and they've done a fabulous job.
And you know, that was a special project of David Rockefeller's, and it's one of the most wonderful dining experiences. And it's also because of Daniel Barber, who is a great chef and who is intellectually a great chef, not just a good cook who makes food good, but who likes to talk about it and write about it. It's going to be leading the way on many of these issues.
And whenever there's legislation that changes restaurant culture, the restaurateurs complain cigarettes were banned, and everybody said it's going to destroy the business. Trans fats legislation came along. Has it had an impact?
It's helped.
Positive.
We were trying to explain that if you have 80% of your people who do not like smoking and do not smoke, you got to help the 80% of the customers, not the 20%. But it turns out that the 20%, which we survey around, do you smoke and then how do you feel? Even the smokers prefer not to have somebody else blowing smoke in their face while they're eating. And it has been in place now for almost 8 years under Mayor Bloomberg. And it is absolutely clear both here and in places around the country like in California and almost every state, it's good for business. And interestingly, the restaurant associations that used to fight smoking bans are now supporting them.
They realized that it was to their benefit, which we had tried to explain at the beginning, but it took a little while before they felt comfortable.
Are you finding that New Yorkers are more sophisticated about ethnic foods? Because I remember early guides, I knew something about Mexican food and I knew something about Chinese food, and I was always stunned by some of the things that I read, how ignorant some of the things were. And now doesn't seem to be the case for me. Are New Yorkers learning about these foods, or are just the people who are reading the Zagat guides?
No, when you're in a really great, huge cosmopolitan market that has many good representatives of different cuisines, you gradually, if you're interested at all, you go taste them and you learn about them. And also the availability over the years of jet travel, which means that we can all pop around the country and experience things that we might not have in New York. You know, I like to go to Mother's in New Orleans and, sadly, a place like Juglasich. But, you know, you couldn't find anything like it in New York. But every time you go to a restaurant and you find a different cuisine that you like, you learn.
Tim said sadly because it's not there anymore.
But it should be revived. Mr. Juglasich, please, please come back. Come to New York. We'll help you.
But New Yorkers are have always, I think, been very open to trying new things. It's one of the most exciting things about New York City, that we have such a huge diversity of ethnicities.
When we started 30 years ago, we only had about 20 different types of ethnic cuisine. We now have 84 listed in the guide. That speaks for itself.
Are you seeing certain cuisines becoming more and more popular?
Well, Japanese has really become incredibly popular over the last few years.
There are neighborhood sushi places now.
Yeah.
Whoever dreamed.
But on the top and in the more...
I was a boy, and if somebody told me I was eating raw fish, I would have said that's a fraternity prank.
Yes, we have come a long way. There was a recent article in the New York Times that described your farmhouse in upstate New York, and the kitchen sounds especially extraordinary. But I can't imagine that you ever use it.
Oh, I love to cook. And unfortunately, I don't get too much time to cook in New York City. But when we're in the country, I cook all the time. And I have a wonderful – I hope you looked at the online version of that, because it showed a picture of my herb garden where I grow every conceivable herb that I'd want to use. And I just love to go out to the local farms, get wonderful ingredients, and use my herbs and make terrific dinners.
The reason the kitchen looks so good is that Nina loves cooking and is a great cook. She was a cordon bleu.
Before you got into this whole thing.
Oh, before,
sure.
Yeah. And we invite you formally right here, right now, to come up and we'll feed you on some weekend.
You beat me to it. I was going to say, when are you coming?
My guests are Tim and Nina Zagat. You heard it. Will you please save the tape? You keep on adding features to this, including things like sleepers and critic-proof indexes. And critic-proof, obviously, Elaine's is one of those critic-proof places.
Well, you know, critic-proof used to be Teflon's until we were threatened by, with a lawsuit by who owns Teflon?
Monsanto or somebody?
It's one of those companies. And we said, you know, we'll credit you and say that it's your trademark.
DuPont.
But they, DuPont, that's right.
I couldn't
and they
believe
wouldn't
it.
Allow
yeah,
it.
Yeah, I would have thought they would have found that
we said we
a compliment.
Would totally, you know, put your trademark on it. And they said you cannot use a Teflon. And what we're really saying is criticism of the restaurant's food doesn't stick.
So we worked at it and came up with critic proof.
Well, I wonder what happens when people called Ronald Reagan the Teflon president, for example.
I guess DuPont wasn't big enough to threaten Ronald Reagan. I just thought that was incredibly stupid of them, and I hope they hear me years later. I always thought, I'm a lawyer too, I always thought that was just bad lawyering.
Do you find that that the surveys are used mostly by New Yorkers, or are they used by tourists because they are the ones who are going to be least likely to know that there's a really nice restaurant
Both.
Around the corner?
Both. I think New Yorkers, of course, use them more times a week. But people that come to New York buy a lot of guides and also use theget.com so that they can plan their trips.
But, it's interesting that most people buy more than one, and they buy one for home, one for the office, and often one for the briefcase or one for the, for the putting in the car. Interesting. We do 650,000 New York books a year, which makes it the number one selling book of any kind every year, all the time. That's why it's at the cash registers of virtually every bookstore.
You know, well, the interesting story I have on that is when we came out with our first guide in Tokyo, we were over in Tokyo and we were being brought to meet the mayor. And I was trying to think of how I would simply explain what our guides were because it had to go through a translator. And much to my surprise, he said, "Oh, well, I know your guides. I use them whenever I travel."
And well, she said, "Why don't you use our Tokyo guide?"
Well, people know that even in the city. Sometimes I find myself in a strange neighborhood or going to theater in some area where I wonder, where should I eat beforehand? What restaurant can I get a nice, quick, inexpensive meal at and open up theater area, 42nd Street or whatever? And mm-hmm. there are all those different restaurants. That, I guess, is the way most people use it. They're going to a different place, or I'm going to Long Island City. Is there a restaurant in Long Island City?
Or you're looking for Thai food, and you don't know offhand what all the Thai restaurants are and what might be near you?
The whole approach that we have, and I think it's different from almost any other guide, most guidebooks, particularly about food, kind of create a paradigm of what they think the great restaurant is. Now, let's say you're talking about Boulay, or you're talking about Danielle.
Both great restaurants.
Both great restaurants, but it doesn't tell people very much to say those are great restaurants. Also, you wouldn't want to eat in them every day unless you had a hell of a expense account and a very strong liver. Most people are trying to make a decision about where to go on the way home or where to take their young children on Saturday or Sunday where they can get up and run around the table and spill, or where to go to be romantic with somebody, or where to go before or after the movies, and so they're now focusing on the movie theater. Or they're taking a client out and they're saying, how experienced is the client, and does he want something sophisticated or want something on the tallest building in the city with a view? And what we're trying to do is help people make decisions that are intelligent for themselves and make them quickly and easily. Each of the ratings for food, decor, or service has a different impact depending on what you're doing and who's paying for it. And the whole target of this, and with all the indexes we have, is to facilitate your making intelligent choices that help you get where you want to be and that are perfect for your purposes on that night. And that, so often, most guides don't seem to be oriented to your needs.
Just one more thing before you go. If you had to cite something that was new, something that was pointing to a new trend, what popped up this year?
Well, I would say the trend towards value. We put a lot of effort into the front of the book, where you can get great prefixed meals.
We're seeing more hamburgers. We're seeing a lot more barbecue now than we did in the past.
Interesting thing is the number one barbecue, the number one hamburger, and the number one pizza have all moved to Brooklyn.
The top hamburger is
Dumont. I live in Brooklyn, I understand.
The top hamburger is Dumont, the top pizza is Lucali, and the top barbecue, Fete Sal.
But, it used to be that these bridges between Manhattan and Brooklyn, when it came to dining, were a one-way street. You came into Manhattan, and then you went home. Now, anybody who really knows Brooklyn dining, as much as they may very well want to go to Brooklyn and not eat in Manhattan, that you can get these wonderful restaurants at half the price. Several years ago, the Times did a front-page story about the grocery on Smith Street. A wonderful restaurant. Gets a 27 this year, 28 that year. And they were shocked. Oh, my God, how could you possibly compare this to the food in New York? Well, the food there is wonderful. We also said it was a spare little place that had prices that were half the price of any of the big restaurants in Manhattan. I would recommend that most people who care about fine food and who are not necessarily interested in glitz and glamour go to the grocery, go to Saul's, go to any number of wonderful restaurants in the outer boroughs.
Because they're generally run by chefs who were looking to do their own thing and didn't have a lot of money and wound up with a lot cheaper rents.
That's right.
And nowadays, they can't go to Smith Street because the rents are so high.
But also, they're likely to be very relaxed in atmosphere and a place to have a good time.
We've run out of time. I'm so sorry.
We always enjoy being here with you.
I just handcuffed myself to the microphone. So can't say that.
Tim and Nina Zagat, the 30th anniversary Zagat Guide just come out, the New York Zagat Guide. And you can find out all about the anniversary by going to Zagat.com. You have a lot of stuff about that. You celebrating? You've been drinking a lot of champagne?
We're doing a lot. Actually, we're doing a lot for a company, a foundation called Action Against Hunger, which is an amazing, amazing contribution to helping people survive, really, around the world.
The hospitality business is always incredibly generous in that regard, and there are a number of wonderful organizations that help when help is really needed. And
that's right.
I think that's something that all of the restaurants of New York should be very proud of, and I think you should be proud as well.
Thank you.
And thank you so much for being with us again.
Well, thanks for asking us.